Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you'll learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm Big Mike, Mike Zlatnik. Today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Chris Miles. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you again, man.
Good to see you again, too. We just saw each other a couple of days ago. So, how you doing? How was your, flight back home?
Uneventful, which is exactly how you want airline flights to be, right?
That's just right.
Nice
That's
and easy. No problems, you know?
That's right. That's exactly right. So, you hail from neighborhood of the Salt Lake City, and you've come on the podcast before, so I appreciate you coming on the podcast once again. We are in multiple masterminds together, the Collective Genius, the Freedom Founders, and you are the expert in infinite banking, whole life insurance, and all that stuff. So I greatly appreciate your wisdom coming on the podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Just to refresh the audience, you live again, you're married, only eight kids, only eight, that's it, right?
Yeah. To be fair, two of them are not my birth children, they're bonus kids, right, from my wife's previous marriage, but still, eight kids together is like the Brady Bunch, but there's no room for Alice, so we have no housekeeper. I am the housekeeper.
That is amazing. I give you all the strength. So I got four kids, and it's hard as it is. You got eight. I can't even imagine having double the you're the zookeeper. In a matter of speaking.
Yeah, that's what makes it easy. If I can handle eight kids, I can handle anyone, right?
that's the truth. You're used to a busy environment. Let me put it this way.
For sure.
Let's talk. You've come on the podcast before, and I just want to kind of refresh folks on what you do. And now it is so much more relevant. The stock market is doing its incredibly volatile yo-yo thing, fearful of the coronavirus. And we are, I don't know when this episode is going to air, but I project there's going to be continuous volatility. So what you offer is something very different. Offer whole life insurance that is used as infinite banking product. It could be a retirement product. It could be just a savings mechanism. So talk a little bit about that. What are the sort of the basics of what is it all about? Let's go back to the real simple fundamental things.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's when we talk about infinite banking, we're talking about using life insurance, specifically whole life insurance, you know. And I've been across the gamut, right? For those of you that maybe didn't hear my previous interview, I started 18 years ago as the traditional mainstream financial advisor, teaching everything that you've always heard, you know, save all your money in mutual funds, you know, ride out the waves, because, hey, the market's averaged 12% since 2000 BC, you know, and all that kind of stuff, right? And I came to know after about 4 years, as I started to look at real numbers, that those numbers weren't really working, you know? And like, for example, the S&P 500, I mean, depending on the day that you look at it, right now, the last 30 years has averaged 7.5% of an actual yield per year. You know, when you actually put the numbers in, the average is higher because of the negatives and positives, and that's a whole nother story. But the actual yield is about 7.5%.
How is that possible?
With the average and actual not being the same?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I first learned this, funny enough, as a financial advisor, and it took me 3 years before somebody brought it up. It was actually one of the product providers, right? He was pitching us on indexed funds, right? And specifically about indexed annuities where they didn't have any downside risk. And he's told us, he said, okay, guys, this was in 2004, 2005 when he was talking to us. He said, all right, if you have $100,000 in your fund and it drops 50%, what do you have? And of course, in unison, we all say $50,000. It's like, great. Now, guys, if you want to get back up to $100,000, what ROI do you need? What rate of return do you need to get? And we all said in unison, 50%, right? Because, hey, you drop 50, you got to need 50 to go back. And he said, wrong. He's like, because if you have $50,000, you make 50% on that. That's only $25,000. You're only at $75,000. You're still short. You actually need 100% to get back to 100,000. And then he said, here, look at this, negative 50 for year one, year two, you get positive 100. You would think you'd have, you know, you think you'd be better off because that average return, you know, negative 50 plus 100 is 50 divided by 2 years, is a 25% average rate of return. He's like, well, this is what every of our financial institutions are using for rates of returns is averages, right? So he's like, therefore you have a 25% average rate of return, but you just broke even. And actually, if you factor in fees, you probably only have like 98,000 or less. So you probably still are down, right? And it blew our minds. And we actually started looking at numbers. We said, hey, from 95 to 2005, you know, what would have been better? Being in the market with all these huge swings or actually being in like fixed accounts, you know, or even indexed accounts, right? And I mean index, not like the spider fund. I mean like index meaning like the ones that don't have any downside risk. And we found out even despite the roaring 90s, we all would have had more money had we invested our money in more certain funds than we did in these volatile funds that had all the highs and the lows. And that's kind of what shifted my mind a little bit, you know, plus realizing that the actual return of the market, even though they might say the average for large cap stocks have been around 10% forever, the truth is it's about 7.5%. If you put into a calculator, put the S&P 500 from 30 years ago till the what it's showing today, you'll find out it's about a 7.5% return depending on the day. Usually somewhere between 7.4 and 7.6 depending on the day.
So if I understand this correctly, what you're saying, it is the IRR, the internal rate of return, really only 7.5% because it does take into the account, obviously, ups and downs. That's the whole beauty about IRR. It actually computes things. It also it takes into the account the distributions The distributions generally in stock market are pretty low. I mean, the dividend
ratio is
low. So there was another.
I was gonna say you're a fund manager. So I mean, the cool thing is like you look at funds, right? Like most people, how they invest in the traditional way. I mean, even if they have the S&P 500 fund, they're still going to have at least 0.5% to 1% depending if it's in their 401k or not, coming out in fees, administrative fees, and so forth on top of it. They're lucky to get a 6.5% to 7% average return. And most people don't even get that good because they have other funds that usually don't keep up with S&P 500, you know?
Right. I mean, the good old well-known fact is that 80% of the funds can't beat the index. So the active managers don't necessarily, I don't know what they get paid for, in essence, in the stock market. The other thing I thought you would mention very quickly is when people enter the market. People seem to enter the market at the wrong time. What's most interesting is when things are going down, people start panicking, they sell, and then things bottom out, but they don't go in until the market hits a pretty good high point, then they go back in, and they miss all that recovery. So being impatient has its own problems. And trying to time the market is pretty hard. Most people get hurt timing the market.
Absolutely. Yeah, most people never keep up. And that's why it's so common to hear people say, wait a minute, I just noticed the growth of my fund has only been going up because I'm adding money to it, not necessarily because the market's going up. And that's when people start to realize, wait, I'm not getting these returns that I should be getting, you know? And
that's right. And we all know the pitfalls of a stock market, especially when the volatile days come in. If you enter the market at the wrong time, you for one, it's stressful. Because it goes up and down, and being very liquid and being very easy to invest in, it also makes people extremely uncomfortable and nervous and unhappy when this thing starts falling down a lot quickly. So it's a psychological thing. And then on top of all that, the real returns are not exactly what the Wall Street kind of promotes. So let's, for the moment, again, go back to investing. Again, let me take a step back and talk a little bit about the investment quadrants and where the whole life policy investing, infinite banking falls in these quadrants. So my audience have heard quite a lot about the investment quadrants, the quadrants one and two, investment grade, fairly defensive quadrants with good downside protection. And quadrant three and four being speculative, and quadrant one and three being cash flow quadrants, and quadrants two and four being the growth quadrants. So when folks invest in a whole life policy, I'm thinking just basics of it. It's safe. Yeah. It's guaranteed by the life insurance company. And most of these companies have been around for a long time. These life insurance contracts, pretty strong financially. And these life insurance companies have been around forever, and they're probably going to be around for hundreds of years into the future. Mm-hmm. So it feels like they got pretty good downside protection, but they generate what kind of yield? 4-4.5%? Does that sound right?
At least, yeah. Over time, the hard thing is, you know, for most people, they say, well, I got to get past those costs of insurance, right? But the way I design them, there's usually low costs up front, and it usually actually exceeds about 5% a year, tax-free net of the insurance costs. So if you were to compare apples to apples with a savings account, it's essentially like a tax-free supercharged savings account. But instead of earning 0.0%, you're actually earning about at least 4.5 to 5% average per year tax-free.
That's a great point. So that's the way to think about this. This is for people to keep cash, especially now. One of the fears today is when the opportunities come in to buy, I'm gonna have no cash.
Yeah.
So they don't want to push the cash to work today because they don't know when the bottom hits. So this becomes an alternative to a savings account that actually pays as you 5+% effective.
Yeah.
So how does it work? If somebody wanted to, let's just go through a use case scenario. Mm-hmm. How do you design a policy for them, especially if they want access to cash? I know you structure it differently than if they want retirement savings. They don't need liquidity years down the road. Mm-hmm. But if they will want liquidity in a couple of years. So how would you structure a good policy? Let's just use an example.
Yeah. So the key to designing a good policy is just minimizing the costs right off the get-go, right? I typically try to do it to where I can put in the max amount of cash for the least death benefit possible, right? Nothing is having a good death benefit because I think you do need that kind of protection. But most often, though, I usually reverse engineer for people. So if they say, Chris, I want to put in $25,000 a year, right? I'll say, great, let's figure out what the minimum death benefits needed to dump in $25,000 a year and keep it tax-free. Because it's, and in a lot of ways, it's like a Roth. But unlike a Roth where you're limited to $6,000 or $7,000 a year, with this, you can dump in almost as much as you want, usually at least 25% of your gross income, right? So a lot of times that's what I'll design is like, okay, let's figure out what we want to do, how much we want to keep liquid. Even in the first few years, I'll even do it to where if people have their 6 months emergency savings, I'll do the same thing I do with my own situation, which is, hey, maybe we move 2/3 of that savings into the life insurance, right?
That's an interesting view. So emergency savings, the emergency cash can be in life insurance. And what are the chances when you need the money, life insurance company will give it to you?
Very easy. And you get 95% of whatever cash is in there you have access to. And it takes about a week to week and a half to get it either electronic transfer to your account or a check mailed to you. So it's
a
not liquid like overnight, but it does take about a week and week and a half to get the money. So it's still pretty liquid.
So it's a loan against the cash value of your policy.
You could do either. You could either do a loan or a withdrawal. You know,
but withdrawal can trigger tax consequences, right?
Potentially, it's you have to go way above your cost basis to do that, and that's most people usually don't withdraw that much. But yeah, you could. So you have to be careful of that. If you want to completely not even worry about taxes ever, then yeah, you just do it as a loan. It's like a secured line of credit, almost like a HELOC. But it's like a HELOC that pays you interest, right? So say, for example, you have $100,000 sitting in there and you say, I need $50,000 of that out of here. You could withdraw it. You'd probably be fine. Or you could just do a loan for $50,000. There's going to be interest rate. Let's say it's 5%. That's kind of right about average for a lot of the companies, you know? So say you take out at 5% for that $50,000. Well, some people would say, well, why would I want to pay that money for my own money? Well, the reason is this, is that when you do it this way, see, if you just withdrew $50,000 out of your savings account, you're left with $50,000 to earn that 0.0% interest, and then you get taxed on that 0.0% interest, right, in the bank.
That's right.
But here, you know, like you're saying, like when you're making like 4-5% or more, you know, net tax-free dividends on that money, now what happens if you borrow from it, that full $100,000, even that $50,000 you've been borrowing, is earning that tax-free dividend on that money. So now, you know, yeah, you might be paying 5%, but you might be earning almost 5% in return too.
Right, sort of a wash. Your money is still growing tax-free at a pretty similar rate to what you're borrowing against. And you don't have to go to the bank and submit a ton of documents, go through financial anima that they got to approve you. So you're getting a loan from life insurance company that's pretty much based, it's secured by the cash in your life insurance policy.
Right.
and they'll do it, as you're saying, in a couple of weeks.
Yep. It's a private loan. Doesn't even show up on your credit. So don't worry about that. There's no minimum monthly payment required. Balloon payment, if you're to call it that, but that's at your death. So balloon payment that's due is at your death, and they just take that off your death benefit. So say that $50,000, you never paid anything on it. You just let the interest grow on it for so many years. Say it gets up to $70,000. Well, if you have a $1 million policy, they just take that $70,000, pay it off, and pay your family the other $930,000.
That's amazing. I mean, that is a pretty strong product. You don't have to pay them the interest. They just accrue it and grow the balance on the on the loan.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I recommend, especially if you're going to use it, I mean, depending on how you use it, right? If you're just using this as like extra liquid reserves, which I am starting to have my clients do just to build up for this recession, right? To say, hey, what's that next opportunity? Let's build up some dry powder here. But even then, like if I have people borrowing from it to go and invest, if they want to go and invest in a property or into a fund that pays them dividends or whatever it might be, it's like, great, take those dividends, use that to put back towards that line of credit. What happens, you actually start paying down that loan, the interest being charged gets less and less, while the interest you're earning is compounding more and more, and you actually end up double dipping on your returns. So to give you an example, I use this example with someone buying turnkey properties, right? They are buying about $95,000 down payments between those two properties. We factored it out with the $1,000 plus a month of cash flow, net cash flow. We factored in, it's like, what's the difference between using this versus a savings account? With a savings account, if you liquidate, you know, 95 of your 100,000, then you start building it back up of over $1,000 a month over time. What ends up happening is after 8 years, you've got about 128,000. But if I did the same thing with my life insurance, same loan, by I borrow it from my cash value, right, from the insurance company for the cash value, and then use that same cash value to pay it back towards that line of credit, the interesting thing is I end up having, instead of 128,000, I actually end up having 178,000 after 8 years. So I made $50,000 more doing the same thing I would have done with my savings account anyways, just because I used my life insurance versus just using a plain old simple savings account. And like you mentioned, there's even better protection too, because, you know, savings accounts have FDIC, which we all know FDIC is pretty broke, you know, but with insurance companies, they can't lend out more money or use more money than they have in their savings, right? They can't go and do their fractional reserve banking. They can't do any of that stuff where they're leveraging beyond what they have. And even if they do happen to go under, they still have reinsurance companies that come in and secure all of that in there. So the cool thing is it's actually safer than a savings account, but it pays you more and it's tax-free.
Yeah, that's certainly fascinating. The compounding of the, I mean, it's basically every dollar that you get back from your investments, if you apply to pay down the line of credit with insurance company, it just accelerates the growth of savings, compounding in essence.
Yeah.
So it's a very flexible product that makes ton of sense. So just curious, what portion of an individual's portfolio, just, you know, as far as your understanding is concerned, should be in this type of product? So if somebody has $10 million, what amount do they, let's talk a little bit about every year saving $25,000 or versus one time, say life insurance should be 5% of their portfolio. So they can they jam in $500,000 into something quickly?
They could try. Yeah, they could definitely try that. I usually recommend, if we're going to do it, split up over a few years to lower the cost some more, and it just gives them a better ROI. But you can definitely jam in more money and do stuff that way too. You can do either.
How does it work? Let's go through a scenario. So one is pretty obvious. You have a policy with some base death benefit, and everything else is a rider that allows them to put more cash in.
Yeah. So, you know, a typical one, like if you're talking about that $25,000 a year, right? And this is, say this is like a 40-year-old or something. I mean, $25,000 a year, usually the first year, if you do a normal insurance policy, a normal whole life, this is the difference between normal whole life versus how I design them, which is even different than infinite bankers in many cases. Normal whole life, you put in $25,000 first year's cash value, because unlike term insurance, which is like the same payment, but it goes up over time, whole life is the opposite. There's upfront costs, and then it goes down over time. So they load the upfront cost. So if you did a normal whole life policy, you put in $25,000 that first year, you've got zero cash because it all goes to costs. Second year, if you put in another $25,000, you might be lucky to have $1,000 or $2,000 in there. That's it. The way I design it, you put in $25,000 that first year, you've got about $20,000 in cash from day one. The second year, you put in another $25,000, you probably have now some of the ballpark of about $43,000, give or take, something like that. So instead of having maybe $1,000 or $2,000, you've got at least $40,000 in there in year two. And usually by year five, if someone put in $25,000 a year, that's $125,000. Usually they'll have about $125,000 by that point. And from that point on, it just exponentially just grows and grows and grows. So that's the difference there.
I completely understand. I think you're doing it through a writer, and it's always versus the traditional, you know, 20 pay policy. Mm-hmm. So we covered that case. What about the case? How do they jam in a lot of money into 1 year? People call overfunding the policy. How does that work?
Yeah. See, in a normal policy, same thing would happen. If 20% goes to cost that first year, you should jam in $500,000, but $100,000 is going to go to cost, right? So you'd be left with maybe $400,000. But there's sometimes I can do things with different companies where I can do get a little bit less cost up front, where maybe it's only taking out 10 to 15%, you know, and that kind of thing, right? So that's why I usually I'll spread it out just to kind of make it less.
Yeah, but help me understand, how does the policy work? How can you set it up so you don't have to contribute next year again $100,000?
Well, it's just like this. You know, most companies will require you to do at least 7 years of funding. But if you jam in a bunch of money in the front year, right? I mean, you can either put in some additional later, or what you do is whatever the cash you have in there, use that to pay the premium for the next year. So you borrow the cash, you know, you pull out the month before it's due, put it right back in. And the cool thing is usually by the third or fourth year, whatever you put back in is going right to cash value anyways. There's like a zero net cost by the third or fourth year. So,
I see. So instead of contributing anymore, the income from the overloaded policy begins to pay for the premiums that you need to contribute.
And, right.
It takes care of itself.
Yeah. So it's always case by case. Like I said, sometimes if we could divide it up in 2 or 3 years, we can make it work better. There'll be less cost overall. But you can do it either way. That's the thing, is that it just depends on your situation and what works best.
Got you. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. So what percent of your portfolio should be in the life insurance? Just again, without giving any investment advice, more like usually or typically people, what do they put? Is that a good rule of thumb?
You know, a good rule of thumb is, it depends on where they're at. If they got, like you said, $10 million portfolio, I'd probably say they don't need to have much more than $1 million or $2 million in that, you know, and they, again, it can be actively investing it too. It depends on how much they want to use it. If they're just thinking to set it aside and never use it until retirement, I might do less. But if they're thinking, hey, I'm going to be using this actively to invest in different deals, okay, maybe you could have a higher percentage of your portfolio. I'll tell you this, I never have people put 100% of their cash reserves in their insurance. So give me an example. There's a mutual friend of ours. He's an operator, a deal operator. He said, hey, Chris, I want to set one of these up. What do I do? And I said, well, what kind of cash do you have? He said, well, I've got $80,000 in cash you can just use right now. I was like, okay, do you need to use this anytime soon? He said, well, yeah, I need about $70,000 of it. I said, well, factoring that whole 20% first year type cost, I'm like, we don't want to do that. We don't want to put all $80,000 into this like you're thinking. Instead, let's do $35,000, you know, do that. So then you'll have roughly about $29,000 available to use. The other $45,000 is liquid and available. He's still got more than that $70,000 to use. And so I said, in your case, yes, I could make more money having you do more, but this is what's right. Do this instead, where now you've got the best of both worlds. You still got that fund there that's got plenty of cash, and you got money to be able to do the investment deal. So again, it's always case by case and how you're planning to use it. But I don't think it's something where you put the majority of your wealth in necessarily. You know, like I like to have my money out there investing too. So I don't even have the majority of my money in life insurance.
Understood, and that's a great point. So it makes a ton of sense, diversification, and it should be part of the portfolio. And the fact that you have access to cash, you can actually, like you mentioned, you can invest 10 to 20% of your entire portfolio in a life insurance policy, but because you have access to cash, you have access to 85% of the money fairly quickly, and that enables you to do other things and can consider other investments. So you're not really losing the liquidity. In fact, you're maintaining the liquidity, and some good comes along. This becomes pretty helpful if an opportunity knocks on your door. So
yeah, You know, I just thought of another strategy that could work well too, if you're trying to get a better ROI on the cash that's sitting around. So you mentioned, what if I had a $500,000 I want to invest it? Well, if we look at it and say, well, hey, the cost, we can minimize if we spread out the years that you pay it. One thing you can do is you can put the $500,000 into their, they have like a basic savings account fund that pays 3.5%. You could throw into that fund and maybe it pays $100,000 a year to the policy, keeps putting it in. So by the end of that fifth year, you've got about $500,000, but at least you made 3.5% of the money that was sitting there. So you're still making money on that money regardless. So there's different ways you can kind of design it and structure it to make it work better to your advantage.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. You know, I'm thinking as a fund manager, maybe it's even applicable to my case, because you could sort of, the fund could take a life insurance policy on me and get a better return on the cash that is sitting in the bank and doing absolutely nothing when earning whatever, 0.25% or something.
Right, exactly. Yep.
So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Let's switch and kind of, or maybe not a switch, but a kind of extend the thought process. So beyond life insurance, you work with folks on their financial planning a little bit, help them design, I guess. So talk a little bit about that. What do you do? Listeners to the podcast, if they certainly this is your area of focus, your expertise. Mm-hmm. If they want to do something like that, you're the person to talk to. What else do you do? How else do you help them out?
Yeah, I work like an anti-financial advisor, right? So I'm definitely not looking to put money, people's money into mutual funds and things like that. I'm more about like what you promote on the show and what you actually do yourself, which is invest in things that are like real estate based or whatever it might be, and more secure, like you'd say quadrant one or quadrant two, whether it's cash flow or growth focused, less, not really speculative, but more, you know, certainty, right? And creating that certainty around creating cash flow. So if someone says, hey, Chris, I would love to be able to retire in the next 10 years with $10,000 a month cash flow. I was like, great, let's figure out with your assets, what's the best way to do that? Now, I won't cross the line. I won't say you should do this or you should do that. I never tell people like you should absolutely do this recommendation of this investment. But I will say, hey, let's look at the different options that are available out there, you know, connect you and strategize and figure out what's the best, you know, what are the best options, and then let you decide from there, give you the risks and the rewards, the consequences and the benefits, and figuring out what actually helps you meet your goals and gets to that place, which, that's the sad thing, is that a lot of the things I actually talk about having people do is stuff that you would never have a financial advisor talk about, because they can't sell it to you. You know, they can't sell you, you know, a turnkey property. They're going to tell you, don't do that. Invest in my crappy fund, right? You know, their crappy mutual fund. They're going to say, invest in that. They're not going to say, invest over here if it's not something they can make a commission on, you know?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Just to kind of explore on this a little bit further. The traditional RIAs only offer the products typically approved by their RIA parent company.
Right.
And a lot of advisors work for bigger shops, so they only offer products, number one, that are generally accepted safe. Well, it's you're investing in the market, you're in a mutual fund, you're investing in it's. It is not viewed as speculative or aggressive when it is. In reality, mm-hmm. some of these stocks should not be.
You're not even diversified.
You're not diversified, but at least you can't complain, hey, the market tanked. If things go bad, they didn't recommend something that it wasn't an alternative. Alternatives are viewed riskier when in many ways they're not. They're much mm-hmm. more predictable. You're calling it safer. I like to use the word predictable.
Yes.
Safety is certainly a good word, and the quadrant one and two deals are safe in the quadrant three and four in general, but predictability is just, it's a key word to describe it. The other really interesting point that you mentioned is their motivation, right? I mean, unfortunately, too many of these folks are commission-driven. They're not purely working on flat fee basis, so They have some motivation, other motives to kind of give you some ideas to what to invest in. But what I really like about guys like you, this was the most fascinating. The crooks, they're going to come in and they're going to tell you, I'll tell you what to invest in, and then they push you into the things that they want you to invest in. The really good guys don't do that. In fact, they push really hard back. They don't want to give you any investment advice. They just want to educate you and help you make your own decision. So And that's the most amazing, because most people are smart. And they don't even realize how smart they are. If they're given the right coaching and the right education, they can make these decisions without anybody pushing them into anything.
Absolutely.
And that's the strength. What good guys do is they don't want to, they're actually very careful, because you want to understand the person, you want to be able to help them, and different folks have different situations.
Exactly. Yeah. People are really smarter than most people give them credit for. And I remember being trained as that mainstream advisor, they would always tell us, hey, you make sure you let them know that they don't know anything, you know, that you basically do the thinking for them, that you're the expert, and they'll just trust you and throw money at you. And that's wrong.
That's terrible. That is wrong. That is, it's disrespecting people. It's demeaning people.
It is.
And there are plenty of people who have been trained to think like that, unfortunately. And when you start opening the horizons for them and you tell them, listen, can't give you any investment advice. First of all, I'm not licensed for it. Two, I don't play one on TV. And three, I'd like you to learn. Most importantly, I'd like you to learn and like to be able to make better decisions with eyes wide open instead of somebody else making decisions for you. So
that's right.
It's amazing. We're sort of running out of time. It's been great. I think it's a lot of wisdom in infinite banking and in the way you approach it. Any other quick feedback, advice, thoughts for the audience? How would they get a hold of you? How somebody wanted to do this, put some money into a good whole life policy with a good cash value, to have access to the cash, and have you know, that decent death benefit. What's the best way to reach you?
Absolutely. Yeah, they can definitely go to my website, moneyripples.com. That's moneyripples.com. They can go there and message me through that. And also, I invite you to check out I have a Facebook page, but check out my podcast. I actually have a podcast as well called The Chris Miles Money Show, where I teach a lot of these concepts and I go in depth with different aspects and angles. So definitely invite you to follow me there too.
And that's great. And
lines are ringing off the hook. I can already tell.
Yeah. It's people are calling right away. They're just calling right now. They want to learn money ripples.
That's right. Yep.
Anyway, thank you for coming on the podcast. Greatly appreciate your wisdom and your friendship. And I guess I'll see you soon at CG. Hopefully we don't have the... I don't know if are you going?
I am. I'll be there next week. Yep.
Well, me too. If we don't, the coronavirus doesn't get any worse. So a little bit scary, but some people say it's a common flu, and some people say it's a little bit worse than a common flu. So
worst case, we look like Bane from Batman, like, you know, something like that. So
That's right. We were laughing about it, but unfortunately, some people are dying from it. So
that's true.
Thoughts and prayers with those who are affected by the terrible virus. So
yes.
Anyway, thank you kindly, and I think we're done.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.